Actually going to talk about what are known as the precursors to Zionism. Precursors, of course, are something related, but is not directly that thing itself. It came just before it, and, you know, it really laid the groundwork in some regards, in many regards. So really tonight, by the end of this lecture, after that, we're going to do totally Zionism as it's focused on the land of Israel. And we've done a lot of groundwork getting up to here. We've covered ancient antiquity and the Middle Ages and the beginning of the modern era and what we're doing, and really what the Hobsbawm book showed us what we're doing is that Zionism didn't arise in a vacuum. Right? There was a lot of it didn't just happen. It was in response to other things that were going on. It was, we're going to see tonight, one of many Jewish responses to what was going on in the 19th century in particular, and in particular in the last quarter of the 19th century. First, I always like to ask what we're reading, because I think that always it's always interesting to ask people not only what they're reading, but what they remember of what they're reading. You know, I have the Hertzberg book, and I've been rereading the introductory essay, which I've read several times. I remember very little of it, but it struck me anew, so I was very pleased with that. One of the neat things is I have my brackets that I always put around things that are of interest to me, so if I'm in a rush for whatever reason that evening, I can just go read that stuff and go back later, hopefully, and fill in the blanks.
Yeah, my problem is too much underlining.
Oh, yeah, I like some people when they highlight books. If you get a used book, they've highlighted the whole page.
I decided the way I read is by highlighting. So it's not really selective enough. So then I put little marks
the highlight and the highlighting?
To highlight the highlighting.
Right. I put the little brackets. So what are we reading? Anybody reading anything of interest? I know there's a lot of reading that's assigned in the course. By the way, David, who was here last week, he gives even additional readings, which he puts up on a website for his class. But I don't necessarily think you guys need additional readings. What we've got covers a lot, and we cover it in lecture two. You're laughing. Oh, my God, more?
But if you want those extra readings, I sent you the links.
Right. They're on his website.
Introduction, okay.
Have you read the introduction? Or?
A few pages.
It's a lot.
And then I
it's not as bad as Hobsbawm, though. Right, it's not as bad as Hobsbawm. You got to give him some credit. Now, Hertzberg was a really interesting, iconoclastic individual from Baltimore, I think we mentioned a few classes ago. That's really a classic text, though. One of the amazing things is always when you have something that's original, and he was the first one that translated this stuff into English. And this book was put out in 1959, when the questions facing the Jewish people were very different in Israel than they are today. So it's interesting to read it in that regard, too. And he, you know, often in my edition, which I have, it's a little earlier than yours. For people like David Ben-Gurion, it has, 1883 to dash. You know, it doesn't say that he's died. Right, Ben-Gurion died in 73, just before the Yom Kippur War, actually, Ben-Gurion died. And a number of figures that were in there toward the end of the book are like that. Good evening. How you doing? What else are we reading? Yeah.
Well, I kind of was inspired by the overview of the Zionist book, that very first one, and I kind of went off on my own.
The Shapira book or the Engels book?
The Engels book, and then I've now become like a serious Rufus scholar because he just fascinates me and what his role was. But besides about him, what the difference between the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah, and the nature and the characteristics of the first one, and the expectations and the support of Rothschild, and that's interesting.
Two quick things. One is that I found that PhD thesis that you talked about.
Eitan.
Eitan Berman or
Bloom.
I haven't read it yet, but I have the link, and it's amazing that he put that whole thing online. So 160 pages or 500, or whatever it was. Yeah, but it's got a lot of footnotes. So, you know, and footnotes are for his professors. They're not for us. So we won't worry about that.
But he has a book out for $125.
I saw that.
A distillation of his thesis, so you can get a free ride.
Right. I Googled his name, and he works at some institute in Tel Aviv or something like that. But it's unusual, by the way, that someone would take their whole thesis and put it online, because they usually turn it into a book. So he's shortchanging himself in some regards, but that's his issue and not mine. But on the first Aliyah, you know, shorthand, getting ahead of ourselves, and we'll do the details, was more religious in some regards. And it was certainly Zionist, socialist oriented. And the second Aliyah was all what we'll call the practical builders of the state. Ben-Gurion was one of the people in the second Aliyah. And Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, who became president of the country, was in the second Aliyah. And we're going to do a whole lecture on the second Aliyah, because those are the folks who really created the stuff that created the state. Whether it's an electric company or a theater performance group, Habima, or an artist school, Bezalel. It's a fascinating period, and it's also interesting, there were five Aliyot overall as the categorizations. Anything else people reading?
The Shapira book.
Yeah, I love
you
that.
Know, I got these books many, many months ago, so I read her first 150 pages, which was up to the State of Israel, and the rest is for like next year.
Right.
And I reread that again, and it was we were just talking before everyone came in. Towards the end of that 150 pages, she starts talking about Masada and how sort of things that we talked about before. And I made a comment about not having bar mitzvahs there or so, but she made a comment that the early yeshuv, people in the early yeshuv, used Masada sort of as heroic place, and there was some literature and poems about Masada that she was quoting. I found that pretty interesting.
Right, and we did the poem from Yitzhak Lamdan.
That was the one.
Right, and it ended with the famous Masada shall not fall again. At least that was the hope, and we continue to hope that. But it became a rallying cry, and even more importantly, in many regards, is it became a focal point for youth groups, which were, you know, integral to the Zionist movement. You know, that they would all go to Masada and hike up Masada. It was a rite of passage. And, you know, again, they didn't go up that Roman path. They went up the snake path.
She talked about, like, youth groups. Some wore blue shirts, some wore khaki shirts. She's very readable.
Yeah, she's a great scholar and a great writer. You know, and there's, this is kind of heretical, but there's something to be said for when the Arabs, for the wrong reasons, say that the state of Israel is a European implant in the Middle East, right? They were bringing their European youth groups over. And they were bringing those structures over. I mean, this was an immigrant country in every single regard. The old yeshuv, HaYeshuv HaYeshan, the old settlement, were pious, observant Jews who weren't interested in building a state. They were interested in being there when the Messiah decided to show up. It was a very passive approach to Jewish history and Jewish future. So, any other books we're reading? Anything? Strike anybody?
I just looked at this book.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah?
I'm sorry. This book is very readable, too.
That book's very readable, and the introduction to the sections are great.
Yeah.
Really great. And we're going to be reading, starting next week, some specific things in that book. But if you get a chance just to read the introductions, they're 1 to 3 pages of each section. They're fantastic. Yeah?
I did the reading in this that was assigned, and I was particularly interested in the letters from the anonymous housewife.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Well, what I liked is that they became successful, even though the few chapters we read before was kind of a negative description of what was going on.
It was a hard life.
They did well, and she was, very happy, and they were very happy in the situation and successful.
Or at least at that moment when they wrote that.
Well,
right, you never quite know for sure.
A few years of time,
right?
Anyway.
Something that I noticed, I had wanted to watch a video on YouTube about Zionism. I didn't know what was out there.
Oh boy, that's opening a whole can of worms.
Well, there's a lot of
exactly
like David Duke's kind of
exactly. I've seen some of that actually.
Yeah, and so. What I found interesting, and maybe this is something that David Starr could do as a result of this course, is post something that is of a very different nature than all the negative, the virulence that are hurled at the Jews through all these videos that are online about Zionism. There's nothing wholesome. The word's not wholesome, really. But there was nothing from a traditional, historical point of view about Zionism. I wanted to cook and listen while I'm cooking, and there was nothing to listen to.
So maybe
to
like a top 10 horrible videos.
But there aren't any.
Yeah.
I mean, I went several pages in, and then it stopped being YouTube videos. So maybe he should add something to it.
That's a good suggestion. I can pass that along. I think one of the things that David is starting to do is use the technology a little more. For example, he told me that he doesn't project things up on a board the way we do. And, you know, I happen to think, look, is, you know, I'm sure that I'm a wonderful lecturer, but it can get a little boring at times to have someone standing in front of you talking. So I think you have to do that type of stuff. It just makes it a little, and the pictures, it just gives a little more life. I think we do need to use the technology. We're going to be seeing some films in here in the weeks coming up as well. I've only found one video so far of Herzl, and it's about 7 or 8 minutes, but, you know, and it's without words, but I'm looking for other stuff too. The Zionist movement came about at a time when technology was changing, right? We'd already had photography at that point, right? We had that since the late 1850s, roughly, because we've had famous Civil War photos from Matthew Brady and what have you. Film doesn't come about really until, you know, just before the turn of the century. It doesn't start becoming big until, you know, 1910 or something like that in the old theaters, you know, or actually a little earlier. Turn of the century is it. All right. Anything else we're reading? David, you read anything interesting? Got a chance?
No, I'm just listening to what people are saying.
Okay, terrific. Anyway, so we're rolling along, like I said. Tonight we're going to talk about, the precursors. Before I do that, I always like to refresh our memories, too. What did we talk about last week? French Revolution and the Jews with the Sanhedrin, Napoleon coming after that, and really how Napoleon spread the Enlightenment with his various conquests as he was moving eastward across Europe, and then he was pushed back, but the Enlightenment kind of stuck around, even though there were some reactionary forces to it. Europe was a cauldron of seething nationalism in many regards, which Napoleon only agitated. Particularly in Italy, he liberated the Jewish ghettos in Padua and Rome and Florence. He's famous for doing that. He was seen as a great liberator by the Jews, although not to the extent like Alexander the Great we talked about. They named their kids after him. Anybody remember the name?
Sender.
Alexander Sender. What else did we talk about last week?
Nationalism.
That was the big thing. We talked about our friend Mr. Hobsbawm. You know, he's got plenty more books for those of you who love that book. I think what we, and I mentioned it a few minutes earlier, what we see from Hobsbawm more than anything else is that there was a whole heck of a lot going on in the late 19th century in Europe. And he's been criticized for writing only about Europe. And he really, every now and then, he talks about something in Africa, but he really only writes about Europe, which is fine. That was his experience, and you know, that's what he was focused on in the various treaties, and it's a lot easier to write about Europe because it's recorded history as we understand recorded history. We also talked about the Enlightenment. Haskalah is what it was called, the Enlightenment. Moses Mendelssohn, the hunchback from Dessau, really being the first one who was a great rationalist, even though he continued to live as an Orthodox Jew. But what we saw, primarily, is that Jews were beginning to change for the first time in more than 1,000 years. Jews were beginning to enter the rest of society. They were getting permission in certain places. Mendelssohn, remember, was granted the title of tolerated Jew. He was able to stay in Berlin. I know, as crazy as that sounds to us, but his wife and children didn't get that title. So they weren't always allowed to be in Berlin with him as part of the craziness of the era. But there was more and more opening to Jews, as slowly as it might have seemed, starting to take place. And with all the nationalisms that were creeping up, Jews started thinking in nationalistic terms as well. And we're going to meet some of those Jews tonight. Any questions from last week or anything else that we've discussed so far? No, we're good? Okay. The modern Zionist movement is going to start officially in 1882. Let's see. I'm going to write that down here. Pardon me for a moment. So the modern Zionist movement officially is going to start in 1882. Hmm. area. We're not going to get to that tonight, but just as a preview, what happened at that point was 14 young adults from Kharkov in the Ukraine who were secular socialists decided to move to the land of Israel and they wanted to be farmers, and they would go on and they would help found the community of Rishon LeZion and a couple other places as other people came from the Bilu movement. Tonight, however, we're going to talk about those who came before them. The interesting thing is they weren't listened to in their day by Jews or non-Jews. They simply weren't paid attention to for a whole host of reasons that we're going to talk about in a moment. These thinkers were both secular and religious, and everything that they said was going to be said by modern Zionists. I'm talking in particular about Alkali, Kalischer, and Hess, and we had some readings on some of their works in the Hertzberg book. And it's worth reading, and Hertzberg's introduction is great too. Now I want to throw us back to last week. Their Zionism didn't take off. So the question becomes, what would help Zionism take off? And I want you to begin to speculate. Zionism would have to be a response to what? And remember, we talked about some key things in terms of nationalism for last week. What would Zionism need to take off? Any thoughts?
A leader.
A leader, okay. Hang on. Zionism is going to need a leader. And it's going to need maybe one... And leadership is a funny thing because it really depends on who responds to that individual. Again, because everything Kalischer, Alkali, and Hess said was already said. It would be said by the later Zionists. And in fact, Theodor Herzl is later going to say, when it comes to a different one of those, Pinsker, had I read Pinsker's book first, which came out in 1882, I wouldn't needed to write my book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. Anything else?
Catalyst.
I think that's a key thing. And remember, the Jews were a beaten and battered people in some regards, right? There had been tons of anti-Semitism and persecution and what have you, but there wasn't one single event that would galvanize them.
An agreement on a unifying idea.
Agreement on a unifying idea. I think that's a big thing.
Still don't know.
Right. Two Jews, three opinions, right? And what we're going to find also is there's going to be vicious infighting in the Zionist movement of the various strains of Zionism. We're going to find religious Zionism, practical Zionism, political Zionism, and cultural Zionism. And then we're going to find the territorialists, which we're going to talk a little bit about tonight. There needs to be, let's say, enough of an agreement about the end goal, of how to get there. And not everybody had that agreement. You might think everybody wanted a Jewish state to be formed. Well, then the question was when? How? Where? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Where? Because Palestine, the land of Israel, wasn't always the place. Anything else?
Well, it may have come later, but really an opportunity.
Opportunity. Talk a little bit about what you mean by an opportunity.
Well, like Israel, the state of Israel, what happened in 1948, and the British actually bring about an opportunity for Jews to have a state.
Well, the British gave up, basically, in 1947. They turned to the United Nations and they said, you know, to quote Roberto Duran in the famous fight with Sugar Ray Leonard or whoever it was, no more.
Right, and that's what created the opportunity.
They created the opportunity. Well, some would say the Jews created the opportunity. But no, I hear what you're saying. Anything else? No? I think this is pretty good. And, you know, we're going to get to this stuff. We're going to get a leader in Herzl, a most unusual leader. We're going to get a catalyst, which was the pogroms in Russia in 1881. We're going to have an agreement that something needs to be done right away, but then it's going to start splintering, and it continues to splinter until this day, because, of course, the Zionist movement today still has its great division, which is what? Any thoughts on what that is? What's the great divider in the Zionist movement today?
Whether you make Aliyah or not Israel.
Well, secular religious is one, but I think there's one even greater. West Bank or no West Bank? That would be the greatest divider in pro-Israelism. I don't even know what the term Zionism means sometimes, because, you know, the phrase is sometimes really interpreted as somebody in Israel would tell you, a Zionist is someone who moves to Israel. right? A Zionist is someone who goes to live in Israel. So I say pro-Israelism a lot, because I think we can all agree that we're pro-Israel, at least as much as anything else. One of the things, too, I guess, catalyst crisis, sense of siege was one of our things for nationalists, whether or not it's realistic. National movements always feel that they're threatened in some way, and that's how they seek to expand their powers, whether that be as an autonomous region within a state, which is what happened in the Habsburg Empire all over the place in this area, or as an independent state itself, which is what would happen to Greece in 1825 when it went independent. All right. Zionism also says something fundamental. Particularly in this area, Zionism says there's no hope in Europe. We need to get out of here. We need to get out of here hopefully quickly, because we must be left alone, because no matter what's happened, it's been bad for us. And what we're going to see in this era is what was primarily a religious-based anti-Semitism turns into a state-sponsored anti-Semitism. There are political movements we're going to see tonight in places like Germany and France where their whole goal was anti-Semitism. Their whole platform was anti-Semitism. Particularly, you're going to talk about Wilhelm Marr in Germany, who really invented the word anti-Semitism in the 1870s. Here's how Hertzberg put it. I believe we have this. Let's see. Hertzberg said, any version of Zionist theory must necessarily imply some sense of a loss of hope in the future total acceptance of the Jew as an individual by the majority society. In the heyday of his success, the middle of the 19th century, so in many regards things were good. This is, by the way, that's my version. It might not be on your page 33 to 34, because I have an older version. The modern Jew could not even allow the nose of the camel of such pessimism inside his tent. I just love that phrase, the nose of the camel. So what Hertzberg is saying is Zionism couldn't take off in this era because things, I'm not going to say were good, but they were good enough for Jews. And in some regards, they were getting better. There was hope for Jews. They had come a long way in a few short generations, right? Moses Mendelssohn dies in the late 1770s, early 1780s. So by the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, things are looking a lot better. So there are people alive who remember when you were needed to be considered a tolerated Jew to be within the walls of the city of Berlin in your lifetime. That's no longer the case. Napoleon has done his job. Now there's been revolutions in 1848 and counter-revolutions in 1849, and various countries are going through various phases of revolution. But nonetheless, Jews are able to side with the liberals, and that's all they did, right? Jews never sided with the conservatives for obvious reasons.
Haven't changed a lot, have we?
Yeah. Why wouldn't the Jews side with the conservatives? They hated them. The conservatives hated the Jews. They were the anti-Semites. They were the ones who were for keeping the old status quo, and the old status quo was not a friendly place to be for the Jews. All right. And of course, by the way, in addition to the fact that Jews who were liberal, or I'll say liberalizing in this area, hello?
Hi,
Neil. Hi, how you doing, Ms. Shockey? Nice to see you. These Jews were liberalizing, so they went with the liberal groups. There were conservative Jews, too, the Orthodox Jews.
Rothschild
was one who funded a lot of stuff. We're going to get to him a little bit. And also Baron Rothschild and Baron Hirsch were the real Daddy Warbucks of the day in many regards. So let's look at the state of the Jews until 1881. Not great by our standards, but again, better than in a long time. A lot's happened. We went through a whole period which we studied in the Middle Ages where not much happened. We were bound by, if you remember, the three oaths. You're not going to go up against the wall, you're not going to emigrate en masse to the land of Israel, and the nations are only going to oppress you a little bit. Right? That was the grand bargain. We had the French Revolution, which we talked about, in Western Europe. French Revolution it's unfair to say that it didn't penetrate Russia. It did have some impact, particularly in the border areas. Remember, Poland was divided three times in 1792, 93, and 95 between Prussia and Austria, or the Habsburg Empire and the Russians. So there was some influence there. Napoleon did try to invade Russia unsuccessfully, as Hitler would also learn. It's never a good idea to invade Russia in the winter. Everybody keep that in mind in case you're looking for something to do this weekend. Haskalah, or emancipation, was roaring along. Schools were opening up. Schools for girls were opening up. Remember, this is a time when girls aren't getting regular education in many places, particularly amongst the peasants. Jews are entering different professions. Jews have the opportunity to go to university in limited numbers, but there are Jewish physicians. There are certainly Jewish bankers, as the Rothschilds are going to show us, phenomenally. There are Jews who are owning timber mills. There are Jews, particularly in areas of Poland, who are owning bars. They're small businessmen. You know, Jews, one of the reasons why Jews would own taverns, not bars, but there were taverns then, was because they weren't allowed to do certain other things. Right? One of the reasons, you can always tell where Jews are in a country by when they start flooding into certain jobs. Jews always flood into the jobs that nobody else wants, that are very hard, or that are new types of jobs or careers. You know, there was a time, David, you can attest to this, there was a time in pharmacy school when it was almost all Jewish. The pharmacies were expanding. It was relatively new, the way it had started developing. My father's a pharmacist. That's why I use that as an example as well. The problems for Jews in Central and Western Europe were primarily internal. They were having their fights about Orthodoxy and Reform Judaism, and we're going to learn tonight about Neo-Orthodoxy. There wasn't any mass killing going on. There was anti-Semitism. There was Jew hatred. But it wasn't as vicious as it had been. It still remained pretty lousy in Russia, although even there, it was getting better. Jews were doing well in England and France, in England in particular. Right? In England, Benjamin Disraeli is the prime minister in the 1860s and 1870s. Now, he's converted out of Judaism, but he still identifies as a Jew. And he was a novelist who had written about Jewish identity in some of his works as well. You're shaking your head. You know a little bit about the Disraeli?
No, I mean, not that he was.
Oh, okay. No, I wanted to share.
And that he was, you know, and that he had converted.
Right.
But he was considered a Jew by everybody. And,
but his political enemies certainly considered him a Jew. What, David?
I was going to say, that was the attack on him. He's Jewish. He's not,
right.
He's not English. He's Jewish.
And that's going to become one of the problems, by the way, is that Jews are going to learn after 1881 that there's no escape. First they said we had to convert, right? So we converted, but now you're saying we're still no good, we're still Jewish. Now, the truth is, many of the Jews converted just to have what Heinrich Heine called the ticket of admission to society.
Mahler.
Hmm?
Gustav Mahler.
Gustav Mahler, and the examples go on and on. Jews were in the hierarchy of various professions, whether it was entertainment or politics. They quickly gravitated, when they were allowed into society, to those positions because they were used to studying and learning and debating and working hard and what have you. And as we all know, it's hard when you're new at something, so you work very hard at it, hopefully, and you're going to do well. In France, Adolphe Cremeau, I know you know the name Disraeli, so I'm going to spell Cremeau for you, because my French is so good that someone might need to correct me. Let's see. Anyone here speak French?
No.
No. Well, Cremeau. He was the first Jew named to the cabinet. He would become a great Jewish philanthropist. He would go on to found something called the Alliance. The Alliance opened a school in Israel, an agricultural school in 1870. And even over in Germany, I say even Germany because Germany is always such a mixed bag for Jews. Even though Jews, by the way, were never numerous in Germany the way they were in Poland or the Ukraine or what have you. A guy named Ferdinand LaSalle, L-A-S-A-L-L-E, was the head of the German Socialist Movement. So again, notice that he's head of the socialist movement, which is a left-wing movement, but clearly he was accepted by this group as they elected him as head. It was, at one point, the largest party in Europe, the largest political party in Europe. All right, so we have examples, and you know, we Jews, by the way, we love to say, play the who is a Jew game, right? The Jew, not a Jew. We love to say, and he's Jewish. So all the Jews in England certainly looked at Disraeli and saw a sign of, hey, anybody can reach the top. Okay, he converted, but he really still identifies as a Jew. The head of the socialist movement. And socialism, by the way, the argument certainly has been made, and I agree with it, is a form of secular messianism in many regards. Everybody's going to be equal, there's not going to be any problems, that nobody's going to want anything, and so on and so on. I'm boiling down complex socialist history, obviously, into a very minute nugget. Let's go over to Russia. In Russia, there was a myth that things were always bad in Russia. During this period, I shouldn't say were always bad, there was a myth that things were always getting worse in Russia. During this period, things were getting better because it was a new approach by the Tsar. This is particularly true, hang on a second, under Alexander II. Alexander II was not an enlightened Tsar. Alexander II wanted to convert the Jews. He just thought he'd use the carrot and not the stick. But as Tsars go, he was a pretty good chap. That's not a great team to be playing on when you're a Jew, but as Tsars go, he was a pretty good chap. He was also known as the Tsar Liberator. He served because he abolished serfdom for all of Russia in 1861. Excuse my handwriting. That's 1851 to 1881. His goal, as I said, was to assimilate the Jews. His goal was to have the Jews come out of their communities, integrate into society, and disappear as Jews. It might happen a little, not as quickly as he'd like, but that was his goal. So, he granted Jews the right to live in more places. You know, in Russia, a certain amount of Jews were allowed to live in your town, right? And the kid grows up and goes into the army or whatever, can't come back to your hometown. Have to go somewhere else where there's permission for another Jew to live. If you had a high school education in Russia, you were given greater rights. So more Jews started going to state high schools, which were expanding. Education is expanding all over the world at this time, including in the United States of America. Right? We have the schoolhouses. I think it was in the 1880s or 1890s, I might be wrong, where education became mandatory in this country. So that's a movement that's taking place all across the world. So by going to a state high school, what language is it taught in?
Russian.
So there's no more Yiddish, and there's no cheder, there's no studying of sacred texts, Limudei Kodesh it's called. There's no studying of how to be a good Jew and raise a good Jewish family. There's meeting other people, maybe boys and girls getting to know each other, creating different types of families, and what have you. Thank you. As entertaining as they are, thank you. Maybe we'll get to hear them during the break. This was not an uncontroversial policy. Many in Russia, including Fyodor Dostoevsky, opposed this very loudly and published tractates against it. So it's not as if everybody in Russia agreed with their Tsar, and they began speaking up. The Jewish community at this time, by the way, had a booming birth rate. I mean, some statistics. This was due to advances in the standard of living. From 1850 to 1900, the Jewish population went from 2.35 million to 5 million. Right? It more than doubled. It was a phenomenal growth rate at this time. So the Tsar saw that he had, quote unquote, a problem on his hands, and he wanted to do something about it. So there's increased pressure for Jews to get jobs and feed their family and take care of everything and have a livelihood. So they too begin entering the society. So these are some of the professions they went into. Taverns, I mentioned, construction, banking, academic work, lawyers, doctors, and scientists. Sounds like a profile of American Jewry today in some regards, how little things change. That really struck me when I read that. Those Jews that were considered useful, and I put that in quotes on purpose, were allowed to live outside of what was called the Pale of Settlement. Anybody ever heard of the Pale of Settlement? It's a massive area in what today is Poland and some of Russia, and depending on how you draw your map at which time, maybe a little bit of the Ukraine, and it's where the Jews lived. It's where the biggest concentration of Jews was, and that remained the case until 1942 and 43, when unfortunately the Holocaust began annihilating that community, literally chewing it up. Any questions until now? All right. At the same time, yeah.
When were young Jewish men being drafted for 25 years?
By the Choppers. That was an earlier czar, and I'm embarrassed to say I mix up the names of the czar. It might have been the first Nicholas, but roughly 1825, his predecessor. Or 1835 to 51. I can't remember the exact dates anymore. But it was just before that. And what he's alluding to is that when Jews, when they were 13, I think it was 12 or 13, the Russians, I almost said Soviets, the Russians would come into the village and they would take the young man and they would put him in the army and he would have to serve for 25 years. Now, when he served for 25 years, you can be certain that he wasn't coming out a good, pious Jew. He had eaten all types of forbidden meats, he had worked on all types of Sabbaths, and he had not studied one iota or one aleph of sacred texts. So that was one of the ways that the Tsars tried to destroy the Jewish community. And then, as I said, that young man, so when he gets out, say he's 37, roughly, that young man, if he's not married yet, needs to get married, have a family, because that's what you did in those days. He couldn't go back to his home village. Not that they would even recognize him. You take a look at somebody from picture of someone at 12 versus 37. You know, you might see an echo of it, but that's it.
What's the lifespan in those days?
I don't want to mislead you. I don't know for certain. So,
so if you're probably better in Russia than it is today.
Yeah, actually, you. Okay. You know, I was in Ukraine about, 8 or 9 years ago. I learned that the lifespan had dropped since the end of the Soviet Union because the Soviets were sending all their bile and toxic whatever downriver. It had dropped from, I think, 62 to 58 or something like that, which is just amazing to think the lifespan in 2013, or then it was 2005, I guess, was 58. Amazing. Some things never change. All right. At the same time, nationalism was building, and it influenced our precursors' design. Nationalism was building all over the place, as we've mentioned several times tonight. Mentioned it had been stoked by Napoleon in response to his invasions. The Greeks had won independence from the Turks in, I think I said 1825. It should be 1832. There were reforms in place in Tsarist Russia, as we talked a little bit about. Germany had seen some liberalizations, and there was German and Italian nationalism. You know, from 1869 to 1871, the German and Italian states unified. Germany and Italy weren't countries until this period. They were separate, I don't want to say municipalities, separate fiefdoms, separate kingdoms, separate entities, where people spoke the same language, where if you ask our friend Mr. Hobsbawm, you know, only 25% of the Italians spoke Italian. There were other dialects, but they were all rooted in Italian. Certainly the Germans were in different German states. It would take Bismarck under Kaiser Wilhelm II to unify everything. The Jews made it clear that they were nationalists with the mainstream. Right? The Jews were hedging their bets in some regards. The Jews weren't talking about Zion and Zionism by any stretch of the matter, based on what we've already said. The reform leaders in 1840 said Berlin was their new Jerusalem. It's chilling today to hear that. But then, Berlin was the intellectual capital of Europe. That's where all the great philosophers were. That's where the socialists were. That's where things were happening, the great composers and what have you. They said, the fatherland to which we cling, they said Berlin or Germany or the German state, was the fatherland to which we cling with all the bonds of love. They're not going to hear from Zionism at this point. And they're a growing movement.
It also, by saying something like that, it eliminates the accusation that they're an alien group of people who might do some bad stuff.
Absolutely.
They were swearing a, quote, allegiance to the country.
Absolutely. And by the way, every Shabbat we still say a prayer for the government. Right? And when I was in Moscow in 1991, I was in the Arkhipova Street Synagogue, and I saw on the wall, I could read in Hebrew, I couldn't read in Russian, a prayer for the government. Right? Jews have always done that. Jews want to make it very clear that they are in favor of the government, whoever is in government. Why? The government can hurt you. Right? So you want to do as much as you can to show loyalty to the government. And this is not new, right? Mendelssohn and the Maskilim have been claiming loyalty to the state as well.
Well, I think that for centuries, the government, monarch or whatever, was to some extent blunting the persecution instigated by Catholicism, which was... wanted to extinguish Judaism but not Jews, because the conversion of Jews was critical to their own justification for what Christianity was all about. The state, when it begins to take hold, as it begins to solidify, doesn't need Jews to justify itself.
Right. The Jews need the state more than anything else. The Jews need the state to protect it, to protect them. And you're absolutely right in terms of your analysis of the way it used to be. There was also, the Jews, even in the Middle Ages, prayed for the leader of the state because the state could protect them from the mob, which the state could sometimes inspire, which we're certainly going to see in Russia in 1881 and then in 1903 and on and off until the end of the Soviet Union. And then, you know, we're going to certainly see it during World War II as well, particularly in places like Poland.
But the Jews also are a good... excuse for all the bad stuff that's happening. It's the Jews that are doing it.
Right.
They're controlling the finance. They're the ones who are, you know, doing bad stuff, and if we can only beat up on the Jews, that'll eliminate those problems.
Right. The Jews are a convenient scapegoat in history. Look, it's fascinating, right? Jews are different. Jews are unusual. And the nationalists, particularly those on the right, let's not use the example of those on the right, nationalists in general struggled with how to deal with the Jews. Remember I told you in the part about the French Revolution that the Sephardi Jews were granted freedom in 1790, but the Ashkenazi Jews weren't granted freedom until 1791 because they didn't know what to do with the Ashkenazi Jews, particularly in the territories of Alsace and Lorraine. They were different. They spoke some German dialect. They weren't quite us. We don't know how to deal with them. Jews in Europe in the 18th and 19th and unfortunately, the 20th century were the other. And the other is alien and strange, and we don't know what to do with them. And there's a whole bunch of different ideas that are going to come up in terms of how to approach it. And it's not all bad, because there were many Christian Zionists in the early days of the Zionist movement. Lord Balfour of the Balfour Declaration, which we'll talk about in 1917, he was a Christian Zionist. He believed that it was a religious obligation to help return the Jews to their homeland. So not all bad. But unfortunately, the bad is really bad in Europe.
I read, I think, in yesterday's paper that the Pope referred to the Jews as their big brothers, his big brother.
Right. Theologically, that's the line that the Catholic Church takes now. Right. And that also kind of makes you feel a little weird.
I'm sure that's a religious...
They mean it in a very benign way, but as Jews, we have certain sensitivities. I call it my Judar. My Judar goes up anytime they speak of that. It's a difficult history, and it's going to take another... You know, as I once told a Christian friend, you know, you guys are doing really good things, and it's really nice, and since there was about, you know, 2,000 years of bad stuff, in another 2,000 years, we can talk about forgiveness. You know, after we have it going in the right direction.
We will forgive them, or they'll forgive us.
We'll forgive them. In another 2,000 years, I'm willing to consider it. You know? which is an easy thing for me to do because I shirk responsibility.
And don't Baptists believe that if all the Jews return to Israel, then the Messiah will come? Isn't that, I'm not sure, maybe it's not the Baptists, but...
Evangelicals. And many Baptists are evangelicals.
Like
not all.
Backhanded kind of, we'll take care of you because we want you to go.
Well, sure. They believe that's the end game, as we say. But they say that I have some evangelical friends, and they say God will work out the details. In the meantime, it's our job to support the state of Israel. So, okay.
So they decide that the lack of conversion is delaying the Messiah coming.
It's always interesting, you know.
Actually, that's not it. They don't want to, they don't need us to convert. They just need us to all be in Israel so that something happens in Israel, we're all destroyed, and the Messiah will come.
Right. But speaking of the conversion, the worst bang for the buck around is Jews for Jesus, when they pour all this money into attempts at converting Jews, and they just get nothing out of it. I mean, they do stupid things like go to Upper Park Heights and knock on doors in Orthodox neighborhoods. I mean, they're lucky they come out there alive.
Some of the leaders from Jews for Jesus were at one point in time Orthodox Jews.
Absolutely. I know. Yeah.
So it does work.
Yeah, there's a guy I'm not related to, fortunately, named Rabbi Barry Rubin. He goes by Title Rabbi, who lives in Columbia, who kind of leads all that up. And he writes letters to the editor of the Jewish Times periodically. I used to never print them, but the current regime does. Anyway, that's another matter. All right. We just spoke for a few minutes about how, despite the bad territory and terrain of Europe, things were getting better in many regards, right? In Russia, they were able to get some education, which is the first step into society and own businesses. There were Jewish leaders in the parliaments of Great Britain and Germany and France. So things were better than they'd ever been. Nonetheless, the dark side of nationalism begins to creep in this period too. And in retrospect, we can see that this is when everything that's bad that's going to happen in Europe begins. Because Europe, if it's anything, is a place of ideology that leads to action. And particularly in this era as well. All right. Jews, by the way, were locked out of certain political parties for reasons we talked about. And there were groups of communists were beginning to form, right? Karl Marx is writing in the 1840s and 1850s. Socialists are all over the place at this point in Europe. The old regime is still out there, right? It's still an uneasy power sharing in some regards. I said in 1849 there was a counter-revolutions to the revolutions of 1848. And the problem for the Jews, a principal problem, when this nationalism came to fore on all sides, is that Jews couldn't say what everyone else could say, which is, my ancestors were with you when Charlemagne did whatever, and my ancestors were with you when so-and-so did whatever. Jews had no claim to the history of the land that they were in because they were locked out of that history, right? They didn't have the opportunity. But that became a detriment in terms of their credibility. If you remember, one of the things that we spoke about in terms of nationalisms and nations was that nations or ethnic groups stretch back to the past to prove their history, to prove their validity. We talked a little bit about, the United States and building Greek, type of temples, which is a way of saying that we've inherited the legacy of that legal doctrine from the Greeks. And of course, in Greece and certainly in Rome itself. So Jews were seen as outsiders by many people on several levels. They were too particularistic for the far left, and they were too unnationalistic for the far right. And those were the very active camps in the nationalist movement in this era. So what's happening is things like in France in 1853, let me apologize for the delay, oh good, in 1853, a man named Arthur, I'm just going to spell his last name, G-O-B-I-N-B-E-A-U, Gobenbois, I guess, if that's French. Again, I'm really bad with languages, so other than Hebrew. So he publishes an essay called "An Essay on the Inequality of the Human Races." Guess who he says is superior? The Aryan nation. This is where the myth of Aryan superiority comes into play, right? So the Nazis didn't invent it, they just capitalized on it. Ironically, he wrote positive things about Jews, said they were, quote, a free, strong, and intelligent people. Even more ironically, as I said, the Nazis loved his work, they just edited out his pro-Jewish comments, which is the absurdity of the Nazi movement on every level, but they were who they were. In Germany, I mentioned a little earlier, 1879, guy named Wilhelm Marr, M-A-R-R. What?
Cousin to Bill.
Cousin to Bill. Oh yeah, Bill Marr. He's known as the father of modern anti-Semitism. He is, unfortunately, the guy who gets that credit. He is the first to use the term anti-Semite. He led the fight to overturn the emancipation of Jews in Germany. He said, wait a minute, we shouldn't give these people any rights. They are responsible for everything that's wrong in Europe. He basically took every stereotype possible, and he fed it to a lower middle class that was willing to latch on to that. And he promoted it, much we mentioned David Duke a little while ago, much like David Duke did. David Duke, I think he was elected to the Louisiana State Senate, wasn't he?
Yes. I think so.
Yeah, I think he did serve a term there, remarkably. He said the Aryan peoples were the highest type of human being, and they were simply held back by Jewish power. He said converted Jews were still untrustworthy, so there's no way out for Jews.
That's been the standard cabal for centuries, generations.
Right, right. You know, so you damned if you do, you damned if you don't. Right? I convert because you want me to convert, but I'm still a Jew. Right? I don't convert, I'm a bloody Jew. You know, what can you do? So, and Jews were looking for ways out. Right? That's why Jews were flocking to the mainstream socialist movements. People like LaSalle in Germany. Right? There, they didn't have to be a Jew. They were just people who believed in equality. That's what it was about. All right. He organized something called the League of Anti-Semites. I mean, can you imagine the can you imagine the sweatshirts, right? I mean, have a heart attack you see something like that. He founded the first political party whose basis was anti-Semitism. That was their whole goal. That was their whole political movement, was anti-Semitism. Wasn't the most popular party, but it got enough votes to get represented in the parliament.
Did he tie that to any of the political goings-on of the day, the socioeconomic conditions?
Oh, absolutely. Always. He was a populist. Absolutely. Yeah, they always tie to that. If it's, you know, an anti-Semite latches on to Jews and the economy. Jews control the economy, that's why you don't have any jobs, because now we've let the Jews into positions of power. The Rothschilds are running the banking industry. You can't open a bank in this town because of the Rothschilds. Timber industry, import-export businesses. Remember, this is a period when Europe has already had the Industrial Revolution. We have factories going great guns now. Jews were beginning to own these factories. And these were really first and second generation of emancipated Jews. He said, look, we made a tremendous mistake here. Let's not do this. So, absolutely. All right, and over in Russia, anti-Semitic agitation was beginning to flare up in the 1870s. It didn't just flare up in 1881. Jews were accused of forming, quote, a state within the state, which is not the first time we're going to hear that. There are aliens trying to dominate Russia. In 1878, the blood libel myth was brought up again. Anybody know what the blood libel is? Blood for matzah, which is, you know, we had seen this in the world, by the way, in 1840 in Damascus, Syria, which energized the beginning to be emancipated Jews of Europe as well, and it helped. That will have impacted, by the way, some of our precursors to Zionism, which we're going to get to soon. Then we get the big blow. 1881. the Tsar is assassinated. This brings the end of the reforms for the Jews. His cousin takes the throne and is viciously anti-Semitic, reverses everything. There are pogroms. Hundreds of Jews are killed. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot in today's day and age, but that terrified the entire population. Even when we get to the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, hundreds of Jews were killed. It wasn't, you know, the massive thing that, unfortunately, we're used to after the Holocaust. Things start looking bad for Jews in Europe in 1881. So when things start looking bad for Jews, what does that open the door toward? Zionism. Right. So with that thought in mind, let's take a break.
Who said that?
There were revolutionary... You guys ready to get rolling again? Yes! I can wait. I'm going to be polite. I'm going to wait.
Actually, wait another little minute because I'm about to lose the battery.
I'm going to wait another little minute because we're about to lose the battery.